I guess it's okay. So my title was
Secretive Violation in Neutrino Oscillation. Which has been discussed a lot lately. And then I continued. It does not come for free.
And what I really want to go through is some intro history of the subject of CPT violation and neutrinos. The motivation of actually looking at this. Then I'll just briefly, for the fun of it, give an example of a model which realizes CPT violation. Which actually comes from a five-dimensional non-commutative field theory. And then I'll describe, okay, so this will be mostly about work that I've done more than a year ago with Maxim Pospalov. And so it was really before Kamland, before the homeotic fermions proposal. It was in kind of the earlier days. So I'll describe our setup for CPT violation for neutrinos. And what this implies. And what this implies is, well, we get neutrino masses and some effective CPT violation, which is potentially relevant for neutrino oscillations. So that was, you know, the setup was good to give us this. But in the same time, it gives us effective CPT violation for electrons. And that is bad, as I'll show. Okay, so we all know that in quantum field theory, any local Hermitian Lorentz invariant action is CPT invariant. So CPT is quite a fundamental symmetry of particle physics. However, this doesn't mean that CPT invariants cannot be broken. And actually, one can think that field theory is just some limit of a different theory, which might, in which one or maybe more of the conditions for the CPT theorem are not satisfied. So you could envision actually getting some CPT violation. And this has been discussed a long time ago and by many people. Kosteleski and collaborators have done a lot of work in this, and Coleman and Gleschow have talked about this. And actually, they also mention briefly CPT violation in neutrinos very early on. And then Sandeep and Tom and Vernon Barger and Kerry Wisnant actually wrote down in early 2000 some discussion about probing CPT violation in neutrino oscillations. So they discuss the fact that CPT violation could be in principle visible in the neutrino sector. Now, this went on, and later on in that year, Murayama and Yanagida actually pointed out that you can use CPT violation in order to reconcile LSND with the rest of the neutrino data. Because as we well know, solar, atmospheric, and LSND required three different differences of mass squares, which cannot be accounted for in a framework of three flavors of neutrinos. And this idea was later picked up by Gabriela Barenboim and Joe Leek and Borisov and a few others, trying to fit all the data with this CPT violation. What they do is, in this phenomenological approach, to basically parameterize the CPT violation by saying that neutrinos and anti-neutrinos would have different masses. And I'll try to argue what we tend to understand by that, really. And
In this case, they have basically, they invoke the CPT violation as giving them the additional degrees of freedom to fit the data as an alternative to introducing light degrees of freedom in the theory, like a stellar neutrino. So what they proposed was, in the early Murayama and Yanagida paper, as I said, they parameterize everything in terms of different masses for and mass splittings for neutrinos and antineutrinos. So if this would be the neutrinos and this would be the antineutrinos, they would have different spectra, and they would explain solar, which we know are only neutrinos here, and atmospheric would come in. And actually, atmospheric in this case would come in a little bit of a funny way, different from neutrinos and antineutrinos, but superheat doesn't really have the power to distinguish this at this point, so it would work out.
In the first paper where CPT violation, the green oscillation was discussed, was the paper by Carlos Bigge from 82, which is called Who is Afraid of CPT Violation?
Okay. I didn't know about that one.
Carlos Bigge. Oh, Bigge.
Okay.
I remember it very vividly because of the title and, of course, because of the content. And then he pointed out that the masses can be different from neutrinos and antineutrinos. The mixing can be different. So all the ingredients are there.
I see. Thanks. I was not aware about the paper.
You just didn't present a model with CPT violation.
Nobody really did.
Okay. So, I think it's a rather complete discussion.
Yeah, in terms of models, nobody really has a compelling model for that.
I don't know that paper either.
Do you know that?
I haven't seen it. And I haven't seen any reference to it either. Okay, so.
There might be a reference in the paper of Scott Hauge.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'll look for that, certainly.
Irina, if there is CPT violation in nature, is there some reason why we might expect it to show up in the neutrino sector first?
Maybe, sure. I'll discuss this later on. But that's exactly the context where you end up with other constraints as well. Okay, so, and then the other proposal of Gabriela and the others was to have this, again, something similar with different spectra for neutrinos and antineutrinos. They have most of the in the antineutrinos, most of the new E's sit here. Have a bit of mu mu and tau. All these are bars. And then a tiny bit of mu E here and mostly mu mu and tau. And same here. And here they have mu and tau. Okay, so from here, it's clear how they want to solve things. They make it easy. Atmospheric is the same for neutrinos and antineutrinos. Solar happens for the neutrinos here. LSND happens here. So they have an effective splitting between the masses of nu E and nu E bar, which is EV in size.
This is the same as this.
Almost. Here, it's just the hierarchy is a little bit different because solar here sits here. Here, it sits on the bottom. Oh. Actually, these people had a good motivation for putting it here. They were invoking the supernova data, which might or might not be really necessary. Yeah, so it's similar. Yeah. And of course, this has changed slightly with the new data.
This is all T gamma, right?
Mm-hmm. After Kamland, of course, they have to get rid of this here, keep just a very small fraction of the new bar E here, and move it down, and invoke the accident of having new E oscillating
nu E and nu E bar oscillating with the same delta M square, because Solar and Kamlan seem to fit well. So that appears like as an accident in this model at that point.
So on the right here, you have actually neutrinos and antineutrinos being degenerate.
Some of them, yeah.
Yeah. Is there any reason why we might expect,
no.
If there really is a
CP, no,
like,
no, 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 this is just, you know, for a toy, easy toy model.
You can slide the upward scale.
Yeah, you can slide the scale somewhat.
Oh, yeah. Just the splitting.
You can slide that.
Yeah. And you don't even have to have the same splitting for atmospheric, of course, as you see here, it's not. And it can be somewhat different.
So you're saying that the degeneracy here is not.
No, it's an. No.
Well, the approximate degeneracy between the atmospheric and the anti atmospheric splitting.
Even
if you break that too badly,
yeah,
it will not support.
You cannot break it very badly, but at this point with present data, you can still break it a little bit. It's not necessarily identical. It can be somewhat different. Okay, now, so what was kind of the initial motivation for even thinking of CPT violation? As I said before, well, you have to think about something which goes beyond normal field theory. And string theory has been invoked a lot because, you know, it's not a field theory. It has non-locality in it. So maybe you don't satisfy the conditions. Maybe it works. Well, it turns out it's not so easy to actually work it out. And perturbative string theory actually gives us low energy effective theory, a perfectly CPT invariant theory. And I guess this comes from the fact that really the string theory is just conformal field theory on the world sheet. And well, there are many things involved, but anyway, it's not easy to work it out to get CPT violation. However, people have invoked non-perturbative effects or spontaneous breaking of CPT. And there are many scenarios where you can actually imagine getting CPT violation. And actually, let me talk briefly about one of them, which was a model that we wrote down, which is just to illustrate that, yeah, okay, in some particular setups, you can imagine that you get such things. And they will actually fit in the framework with all the rest. So as I said, the framework is a five-dimensional theory, non-commutative field theory. Now, what are these non-commutative field theories? They sound like very crazy, weird animals because they live in a space where coordinates no longer commute. And fields become operators and so on. Well, is it really all that crazy? And let me give you an example why it's not so crazy. And actually, you've seen this before. Very simple physical model. It's some anti-symmetric tensor. Just some constant anti-symmetric tensor. Yeah, it's constant. Well, yeah, it's an anti-symmetric constant diagram there. And let me tell you how you can see that you've seen this before. Just look at a particle in magnetic field. Simple particle in magnetic field. Write down the Lagrangian for it. And now quantum mechanics. Commutator X and P. Well, if conjugate momentum is different from zero, right? Now, what is the conjugate momentum? Well, you get a piece from the kinetic term here when you take the derivative 2x mu, and you get a piece from here. And now, get the limit where B is very large. In very strong magnetic field, B is very large. It's much bigger than the kinetic term. You can drop the part which comes in the kinetic term in P, and then P is just proportional to X. So you get exactly something which looks like commutator of X nu is proportional to 1 over EB. So it's a very simple setup, actually. And that's very similar to what happens in string theory when they have D brains in these B fields, which are some anti-symmetric B field. And that's exactly kind of how it goes. And of course, you don't treat this problem by looking in a theory with non-commuting coordinates and funny operators and things like that. And that's the same thing which happens in the string theory, motivated non-commutative field theory as well. And of course, it has been shown that you can write the same theory in a normal space with normal fields, except with additional interactions. And so there is a very well-defined relation between the operator fields and the normal fields. Actually, I won't write this down anymore because it's not so important. If you think of a Lagrangian that you want to write down in this theory with operators, it has to be expressed in terms of traces over operators. So it's something which goes like 1/2 Okay, now, if you want to re-express this in a normal theory, it turns out that it reduces to just a normal action. And if you write down the relation between the operators, the phi in the operator formalist and in the normal theory, it's very easy to see that just by an integration, well, I have to define the funny thing first, plus a potential, which this potential has external interactions, which are completely described by the Moyle product, the star product, which is just, Okay, so basically, all that happens is that you end up back with normal theory with normal fields, except you have these extra interactions, which look very funny, actually, and can give you very crazy things.
Let me ask you something. Coming back to this previous model where you can split the masses of neutrinos and antineutrinos in a different way. Doesn't that require that neutrinos are Dirac particles on the limit when CDP is concerned?
Not necessary.
No.
No, not necessarily. Actually, I'll show you exactly the opposite thing.
The spectra don't look like that anymore.
Yeah.
You have just one spectrum.
Yeah.
But suppose
you have Majorana neutrinos. Yeah. They are Majorana neutrinos in the CPT conserving case.
Okay, yeah. Then you have the CPT violating curve. So what happens to those neutrinos?
What happens is that instead of each neutrino being a 50-50 mixture, each mass eigenstate being a 50-50 mixture of coupling to E and coupling to E bar, the coupling coefficients now can be unequal in magnitude.
I'll show you exactly this.
Oh, but wait a minute. The question is,
excuse me, I thought she was talking.
Of course, yes. But it's in, I mean,
this is a
She
this
said she was going to ask. She was going to answer the question.
Irina,
if you want to give today's seminar, that's okay.
No. Suppose we have three mixing of three Majorana neutrinos in the CBD conserving
curve.
Then you have the CBD violating curve. How many mass eigenstates you have after you have this curve?
Six.
Okay.
It's a little bit funny because, well, I'll show you how it works. Because you have this, you have to add the CPT violation somehow, and you have to define how you add it. So you add extra dimensions of.
Which is CPT violating.
Yes, I'll show you what I add exactly.
Okay.
So let's go on now. Okay, so now that I described roughly what these non-commutative filters are, let's just take a simple example of a five-dimensional model where, and that's very important, all the fermions that I'm talking about propagate in all dimensions. And that's essential for this to work. And what happens then? Okay, and now we want to work in a limit where e squared times theta is small, where, okay, so many funny things can happen in such theories. But if you're in this regime, you can still make sense of an effective theory. And it's still consistent to do it. And then you can expand. And you really need both e and theta to be rather small. And then you can expand this product. And you just write it down. Well, to write down the first thing, the term linear in theta. So you pick up a derivative on each field. And actually, from here, it's easy to see that why the kinetic term and the mass term are not modified and only the potential gets modified. Because you have a derivative on each of these. So if you integrate by parts, you move both derivatives on the same field, but you have an anti-symmetric theta mu. So that's why only the potential gets these funny interactions.
Can you say again, what's the relation between the non-commuting space coordinates and this Moyle product? This Moyle product allows you to rewrite the Lagrangian in terms of something more familiar?
Yeah, so basically what happens is that you start, exactly, so you start with the action written in terms of traces over operators in the space where X's themselves are self-adjoint operators, non-commuting operators. And by this, well, and as I said, there is this very well-defined relations that I didn't write down anymore between the fields, the operator, in the operator formalism, in the non-commuting case, and normal, this is a normal field in normal coordinates, and times and then you just use this and expand your exponentials and you end up with exactly. Here you do, actually. Yeah, and the opposite, the conjugate one, is the phi, is just here. I have to have the traces. It's equivalent, it's a trace here. So here you have a trace, which here becomes an integral.
When you write down the top line, you're assuming that phi commutes with x hat.
Well, phi here, yeah, phi here is just a normal field in the normal theory. Well, actually, it can get very complicated, and there is a very precise, definite map between all these fields.
But when you write an equation like this, you're somehow assuming that phi commutes with x hat.
Well, yeah, because these are really different approaches to the problem. So they're kind of separate.
It's like you're extending the field in terms of x operators.
Yeah, yeah. So these phi are just like if you want some kind of coefficients of the expansion.
It's the same as assuming that x commutes with x hat, right?
Yeah, yeah. Because really, x is x coordinate and x hat is operator. So the x's are some kind of coefficient for the expansion of the operators.
Does this give any insight in why quantum mechanics you have quantize x in the field theory?
Sorry?
In quantum mechanics, we quantize x in the field theory, we don't.
I don't think.
That's a confusion. I mean, X is just a label. It's not a dynamic variable. The analog X is fine. You should call it Q.
problem with analog Q in this one.
Yeah.
Then you have several particles, Q sub I. I is the first one.
X is just okay. So now, going back to my 5D model with fermions propagating everywhere, and then I write down just a simple Yukawa interaction between this fermion and some scalar. And now, if all space coordinates are non-commuting, the three in our four dimensions plus the fifth one, then I have to add to this interaction term coming from the star product. So basically what I have, the correct action in this case would be having the stars here. So now if I expand the stars, I get this term plus the term linear in theta. Where these things now can take the value 5 as well.
We haven't decided yet.
Well, it's in there. It okay, has to be in there. Good. Okay, so now what we're really interested in is when one of these indices takes value 5, and actually what we look at is self energy for this fermion two loop, where now these vertices are really the full vertices, the vertices with the star. So you just compute this two loop amplitude and keep the term proportional to theta. And the term which has a theta mu 5 in it, to no big surprise, will come. Okay, so basically what you generate is a term which in for all a term like this. So if you pick up just the fifth coordinate here, you generate a term which is proportional to psi bar gamma mu gamma 5 psi. So now so what I mean by this diagram is really that from the fifth dimensional theory, I take the fifth dimension to be compact on a small radius, and I compute this where these are actually the KK modes of the fermions, and I just look at the lowest order KK modes.
What is the definition of gamma 5
here? This is the four-dimensional gamma 5.
It's the four-dimensional gamma 5.
Yeah.
So the line above is sigma mn, that's the five-dimensional sigma.
Yes, mn. Yes. And then
so that has gamma mu gamma, the five-dimensional gamma
5.
It contains
not exactly, because what I'm really looking at, that's why I went back. So I write this down in the full theory, but then I just want to compactify the fifth dimension and just look at the four-dimensional theory with KK modes. And that's where I compute this loop. Mm-hmm. So in this, everything now is really, yeah. It, okay. Well,
yeah, so already
done. It's, okay. It's KK modes in four dimensions.
So where are KK modes here in the loop?
In here.
Inside the loops.
Inside the loops, yeah. And if I just expand, keep all the vertices have these thetas and keep the term linear in theta, I do generate the term linear in theta, which looks like this, and I can even give you the coefficient. It's some something.
So they're suppressed by the KK radius.
Yes, and the well, yeah. Let me. This is of course just an effective theory. You have to have some UV cutoff, and then this would be just the masses of the first KK mode. So this was just to illustrate, and of course. Now, if you look at this in four dimensions, it's CPT odd. So this wasn't really something to be taken very seriously, if you want. It was just an example that, indeed, if you introduce funny things, and of course, you have to see immediately what the funny thing was that we introduced to start with, theta mu nu. Theta mu nu is some constant anti-symmetric field. So that already breaks Lorentz invariance,
sorry,
and you have the extra compactification. Yes, it does break Lorentz invariance. And it breaks.
I don't understand now. Why do you do this two loop calculation? What do you want to do with it? I mean, what is the aim of this exercise?
So, the aim is to show that you can actually obtain a four dimensional operator which breaks CPT.
Well, why don't you just add that term?
Hmm?
Why don't you just add that term? Nobody would stop you, right?
Which?
Yeah, I'm asking the same question that Sergey is asking. Why don't you just add that term?
Because it will contribute to the mass of the neutrinos.
It, if you take the zero well, it, so here I'm not even talking about neutrinos yet. I'm just, yeah. So, but then.
But this not only breaks what Lorenzi mentioned, breaks rotation invariance too, right?
Yeah.
If it's
really sure. Mu, well, it, once you have the theta mu nu in there, this already breaks Lorentz because it defines a preferred direction in some funny B field which is constant, which has some direction already. So you broke Lorentz invariance to start with. Yeah. Exactly. And that's why actually these theories are extremely strongly constrained in general. And if you try to do this, here it's just Yukawa theory, but if you really try to put gauge theory in this, you get very strong limits on non-commutativity scale, exactly coming from the fact that this thing is Lorentz invariant and you have very strong constraints on Lorentz.
Lorentz invariance is much worse than breaking Lorentz invariance, the bounds on rotation.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But that's why here with Yukawa, it's not. So if you put gauge here, I can tell you, we did this long, long ago, 99 or so. If you put gauge theory and you make it non-commutative, you get bounds on square root of theta to be bigger than something like 10 to 14 GeV. So indeed, it's very strong. Exactly because of the Lorentz non-invariance of this, it's, you get very strong bounds. But anyway, this was just to illustrate that, yeah, in principle, from some funny theory, you can get some CPT odd operators in our theory. And now, let's go to the neutrinos and to the question that somebody asked before. Why would you have this rather for neutrinos than why would you have CPT violation for neutrinos rather for anything else? And the answer is this was, for example, essential to have the fermion propagating in all dimensions. But if we think of our normal fields in the standard model, you usually don't like them to propagate in the fifth dimension because you would run into lots of trouble with lots of other things. But you can have a singlet neutrino which can propagate in fifth dimension, can acquire such a CPT violating effect somehow. And then it would couple to our normal neutrino. And that's why the first place you would actually transmit the CPT violation would be in the neutrinos. This is, of course, not very concrete. It's just a suggestion. Actually, that has been said before, and everybody, like, that's how they introduced the idea of CPT violation to start with. And why you would rather have it in only in neutrinos, and so on. So now let me get to actually talking about the setup for getting neutrino masses and CPT violation in neutrinos and what comes with it as well. I don't know. I know that there are extremely strong constraints in CPT of CPT violation in all pretty much normal matters that we have, electrons, protons, and other things.
And there's a paper by Sean Farrell where he studied the cosmological constraint of CPT and he put some bounds. I mean, like, I don't know. When he look at the not cosmological, I don't remember the details, but I know that he take a kind of specific interaction with violet CPT, and then he put bounds on the topic.
Yeah, I guess it's the same approach where you actually introduce the CPT violating operators with some coefficient in front, and then you look at the consequences, and that's the essential point. So that's our setup as well. Okay, no matter where the CPT violation comes from, if it's string theory, if it's other theory, it's something else that we don't really know, because we really don't know and don't understand the theory which would give us really CPT violation. But no matter where this comes from, when we look at our own world and our own experiments, we know that everything is described very well in terms of field theory. So no matter where this comes from, you have to be able to write it somehow in an effective field theory approach. So the only logical thing that you would do to be able to really make sense of this would be to add this kind of CPT odd operators in an effective Lagrangian. And the tricky part is that all these operators break Lorentz invariance as well. And that's actually where all the constraints, both the astrophysical constraints and the experimental lab constraints come from mostly. It's the Lorentz which constrains you most. Because once you have this, so basically you interpret all this violation of CPT as described by these background fields and these defined preferred directions. So you'd have very funny things happening. And it's not very hard to constrain them quite strongly. And
probably these operators are local. If you have a non-local field theory, I don't know, but I would guess that you can have CPT violation and still maintain Lorentz invariance. I don't know.
It's very hard to do it, and nobody has actually done it properly. And there are several issues that come in. First of all, one easy way to approach the problem is that any non-local actions that you write down, you can still expand in an infinite number of local, exactly, derivative on local fields, and you get back to it. Also, you know, just, and this would apply, so even for non-local things, to start with, we know that for a general tensor with n indices of rank n, CPT acts on it with a minus 1 to the n times the conjugate. So each time you have even number of indices, you get something which is CPT conserving. Each time you have odd number of indices, you get something which is CPT violating. Well, to get something Lorentz invariant, you have to get rid of all indices. So you're forced to have even number of them. So you usually conserve CPT. So even in the non-local case, if you expand it in infinite number of derivatives on local terms, you end up with this. And I don't know how, nobody knows how to build a non-local theory which actually breaks CPT and conserves Lorentz invariance.
Well, on the first day of field, I must be missing the point, but on the first day of field theory, we showed that the decomposition at the positive and negative frequencies is a Lorentz invariant.
But people have tried doing.
Then you're done. I mean, you leave out.
Yeah.
You leave out half, and so I don't understand how.
Well, explicit examples where you use that fact to construct such theories in which mass of neutrino dimensions are different, you can then show that it's true on shell, but when you go off shell, it violates Lorentz.
Yeah, so.
No, there's no physics that's off shell in the whole world.
No, but. Okay, so first of all, what do we understand by having different masses for neutrinos and antineutrinos? You cannot write down a terminal Lagrangian which has a mass for the neutrino and a different mass for the antineutrino. That, of course, makes no sense. And if you go to Hamiltonian formalists, fine, but in Hamiltonian formalists, Lorentz invariance is never manifest. So that's why it's very easy to hide things if you just talk about Hamiltonian formalists and you never go back to actually describing your theory otherwise, because Lorentz invariance is never manifest in the Hamiltonian formalism. You have to work hard to prove it in Hamiltonian formalism.
And if this is a field, Lorentz invariance is not proven. So the question, can we have a CPT?
Well, so that's what I'm saying. You have to find a way of creating a theory which is non-local and conserves Lorentz and violates CPT. Nobody has done that. So all we know how to do is to write down this effective Lagrangian where you add up CPT odd terms. And this have been classified for many by some people. And basically what you can write down are terms which are exactly of this kind. Psi bar A mu gamma mu psi and psi bar B mu gamma 5 psi and so on. These are pretty much all you can write down, actually. So you have this A and B, which are just some background, really. Yeah, some background field. It's not dynamical field anymore.
But I just try one more time. I don't understand what happens if you break psi and psi bar into positive frequency parts, just an ordinary old quantization, a Lorentz invariant decomposition, and then you couple differently to the two parts, then you break CPT right off the bat.
Well, as I said, that is really
a trivial remark to me.
Yeah, but that then now you're back to the Hamiltonian, where you split operator, creation and annihilation operators, and you write down the terms. But do you understand really what happens to Lorentz invariance there? It's not non-trivial, I would say.
Well, I guess you can generate the canonical formalism, generate the every operator, but I'll let that out.
Can I just simply remark?
there is a very simple way of constructing a CPT violation theory, which looks like Lorentz invariant. Okay? Shall I do that for you? Suppose you go to the old Feynman-Gelman current into current theory for interactions. Okay? J mu into J mu dagger into G of thermic coupling constant. This violates CPT. This looks like a Lorentz invariant because you have contracted mu, but it is CPT violation. It is issue.
What?
The way we solve this problem is to write an anti-commutator of J mu J mu dagger. That is the only correct form of Feynman-Gelman theory. But if you do not symmetrize J mu and J mu dagger, charge raising and the charge lowering current. I'm talking about the old charge current interaction. Just take two currents which are not, take a current and its Hermitian coordinate, a non-Hermitian current. How do you construct an interaction from a current? You multiply current by current and sum over the indices mu, right? J mu plus and J mu minus, I mean, charge raising and charge lowering. J mu plus into J mu minus mu summed over looks like Lorentz invariant, but it violates CPT, that's all I'm saying. It's a simple exercise.
It's not renormalized.
But we can normalize it by 1 hour.
It's okay.
Huh?
It's not renormalized. It's a four permutation.
Yeah, but renormalizability is not that sacred. We are only talking about more sacred things.
That's right.
So,
but I'm surprising these
violations.
Yes, yes. Right. The initial issue. Because under CPT, J goes to J dagger. Right? So J into J dagger will go into J dagger into J.
Wait a minute, you have to take the normal sort of
problem. You got the answer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that, suppose I don't do it.
Then you get real of this, of course.
Yeah. That is the answer. But it's Lorentz invariant. That theory which is not normal order, is Lorentz invariant.
Okay.
See the original proof of CPT theorem.
Yeah.
One of the conditions was theorems have to be normal order.
Okay.
But suppose I don't do it, then it is CPT violated. Okay. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, so our approach was, well, take an effective theory where you add the CPT odd operators. And now, as I said before, you don't really want to put the CPT violation by hand in the low energy theory because then you didn't gain anything. If you add the extra degrees of freedom already in at low energy, you didn't gain much. So we take the standard approach for neutrinos where you say, well, we have a singlet neutrino. And that's the one which will actually fill the CPT odd interactions. So what we start with is kind of the standard seesaw picture where we have the norm. Well, so it's a heavy Majorana N. And to this, we add this CPT odd terms. Okay, and now if you really work it out, you see that if you have only one generation, only this one remains because this has to be anti-symmetric, so we get rid of this one for now. And we just look at this. So now in addition to the normal Majorana mass term, you have this extra funny interaction there. And of course, because we want to end up with something related to the low energy neutrinos, we add a Yukawa coupling to, which will give the mass for the lower. For the normal neutrino. It's a Yukawa coupling.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It will. Yeah. If you don't have this thing, it would be a Majorana. If it once you add this thing, you would have to basically re-diagonalize your states, which will no longer be.
The only thing I'm saying is that this last term is a Dirac mass term. Nothing else.
Sure, but now I really want to say, so this N is heavy, this M is big, and I integrate it out, and I look at what I get at low energy. And what else can I get?
I get the usual, you know, if I didn't have this, I knew what I had to get, so of course I still get it. Times. And now this is going to be usual CISO master. But now I have this funny thing also. And this will look like this. So this will give me something which looks like new bar. Okay, times B1. Okay, to get this, you know, we can do it in many with many different ways. One easy way to look at it is just that now you have this Lagrangian to start with, and you want to the propagator. Now you have, in addition to this term, you have another bilinear in N and transpose. So you invert this new propagator, so you have really a propagator something like that. And you expand this, and you get the normal term, which is going to end up here. And then the other one, which has b slash gamma 5, which is this one here. OK, so what do we have now? Well, we have these two things now. This looks like the normal small neutrino mass that we usually get from the CISO. But now we have this extra term, which, if you look at it, so it is CPT violating. It's an effective CPT violating term that was transmitted from the N, singlet N, to the new. And you can think of this, the way I like to think of it, is that this will really induce some asymmetric dispersion relations for the neutrinos and antineutrinos. So it acts like an effective splitting between the so-called masses of nus and nu bars. So this would be the potentially the term which would be relevant for oscillations.
It doesn't transform like mass.
Sure, not any, no. And that's why, you know, before you basically had just, if you think of the low energy neutrinos, the nu L's, right? You had a nu L and a nu L conjugate for which you used to have just the mass terms. Now, in addition to this, you have this funny beater, which will come actually B slash and minus B slash here. So now you have to rediagonalize this and you get an effective splitting which will go like B, which would potentially give you the neutrino oscillations, different neutrino oscillations, if this term is EV-ish in size.
But this is a neutrino oscillation which knows which way is that way.
Exactly, because of the B mu.
Right.
Exactly. So it's a very funny neutrino oscillation, which, as you said, knows which way is that way.
Right.
But it looks like a CPT odd effect in neutrino oscillations. OK.
The here I can understand that the mass will come because you will get the zero component, because you will take just gamma zero with B zero.
Yes,
good. Yeah. So, but now the point is that B mu or B zero, it should come from theta zero something.
Who's theta?
I mean the theta you introduced in the commutation.
Oh well.
But I think there is.
It doesn't have to come from that.
It has to, because you have just one index, B mu.
Well, let me put it this way. The term mu nu, you can think of it like the equivalent of a B mu nu, But the B mu is really the field strength, and what you really have is a coupling with a magnetic field, which is just a vector with a fixed direction. It's the same thing here. So this B is related to that, but this is just a vector, or an axial vector, as I wrote it down from the very beginning. It's a B mu gamma mu or a B mu gamma factor.
The oscillation here is the energy dependence. Is it normal?
No, actually, it's non-trivial. It's non-trivial. Here, you can really have space components to be mu, and it would look funny. Just as you said, it would look funny. Okay, so this was the good part, right? We got what we were looking for. In a framework where we don't put this in at low energy, we put it in the singlet, and then we transmit it through a UCO coupling to the low energy neutrinos. Well, this is not the whole story, though. This is just the beginning of it, because we have to remember that we put in a UCO coupling, and we also have SU2 gauge invariance. So in addition to this simple three-level diagrams.
Excuse me, I think it's related to this discussion that just went on, but in normal neutrino oscillations, I think of phases of being developed as neutrinos propagate.
Yeah.
Now there are different phases for the neutrinos and the antineutrinos, but they're spatially dependent.
You can think of it like an effective potential, like a matter potential, but now this potential really has all components in it, or could have all components in it. So it could look very funny, but it would be an effective oscillation, which is CPT violating.
Can I ask something else? You make, for example, in this case, from three mass eigenstates, you get six, right?
Well, here I really have, from one I get to two.
If you include the three flavors, you will get six mass eigenstates. Now, isn't that somehow in conflict with cosmology or something like that? It depends how they are activated, of course, in the early universe.
Well, if you want, one thing is that this term really would act just as a small perturbation. Well, yeah, there you count degrees of.
No, the DBM bounds, we bind del time square times mixing angle, less than something. But the del time square, the mixing angle between the mu and the bars are small.
No, I guess the question was more like counting degrees of freedom than.
Well,
you.
They're not activated, you say.
They're not thermal as you're counting.
I don't know. That depends on the strength of this.
But I thought now they're the same neutrino, so how do they not get activated? They feel the weak interactions or not?
Sure, and that's what I'm going to use now. But I guess the idea would be that this is really just, so you still have just these neutrinos, these fields, but they have this funny interaction, actually, which gives the effective, which gives new degrees of freedom, rather, which, so it's not, there is no new neutrino field, really. There is no new neutrino particle. It's just that you have the extra funny interaction with this B mu, which gives the effective extra degrees of freedom, which look like neutrinos.
Yes. Go on, but normally you have a left-handed neutrino.
Yeah, that's exactly
right. Right-handed neutrino, and those are two luminosity states that I count. Are there two more?
It's exactly like, how did you count this before? It was
three.
It was new left and new left conjugate, which was.
But it's Majorana, so you just knew one.
So here you had just a Majorana one. Now it's no longer really a Majorana because of this extra interaction.
It's like 3 Dirac, you would say? Like in a certain sense.
Effectively. Effectively, yeah. So, as I said, before you had just new left and new left conjugate. And now instead of having new left and new left conjugate, you have to redefine your states. And you have extra degrees of freedom coming from these Bs. But so before you couldn't make the difference between new left and new left conjugate, really. Now you make a difference because of this extra interaction. That's how I look at it. Okay, so now going back to weak interactions, and the fact that I actually added there a Yukawa term. Well, at loop level, I have this funny thing going on. Here I have the doublet. And here I have this N with the funny B slash gamma 5 interaction. And okay, so now if I actually compute this diagram, I do get a contribution which looks like L bar gamma mu gamma 5 L let me call this B mu 3 level. Now I get from here a B mu loop, which if I assume that this M is rather heavy and also my cutoff for the effective theory is some lambda UV, which is even higher, this will look like Y squared B mu over 64 pi squared, so with B mu loop in front here. That I just compute, and it's this term. And now, so I create one of these for the neutrino, and I also create one of these for the electrons. But for electrons, we actually have experiments. And there are many types of experiments. The one which provides strongest constraint is, well, they look at a chunk of material with polarized electrons and monitor precession of these electrons. So if you'd have this B, again, you're using mostly the Lorentz non-invariance. Because if you'd have this fixed B, funny B, you would get differences in the precession of those. You couple this B to a spin, and you have funny precession. So from that, they actually get a limit on B for the electron to be smaller than 10 to minus 28 GeV.
Can I trouble you to say again what the experiment is, what they're actually looking for, and who did it?
Okay, so it's a Seattle group.
That's how
Adelberger.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now what do they do?
That's what they do.
No, but how do they do that?
So they have.
You say it again.
They have a chunk of material with polarized electrons, and they monitor for this for a long time to look at the precessions of this electron, and if you'd have such a B term would be coupled to these electrons. So if you'd have such a term for the electron, you'd get some very funny precession of the spin of the electrons around this B.
And this is an experiment that has to be done with a very strict limiting of stray magnetic fields and things like this, which would, of course, also make a spin.
They take this in principle into account. And actually, there are many different types of experiments. This gives the strongest bound, but there are also this atomic physics experiment with, again, atomic clocks, which again look for precessions of spin in fixed B field. And they also get limits. They get limits which are 10 to minus 26 or so. So all the experiments, different type of experiments, seem to get consistent results.
How are the limits on the fourth component?
For B0, there isn't really such a limit, such strong for B0. Yeah, they're not as good, and you can easily see factors of the order of 10 to minus 3 or so, which would come in just using this limit already. You can use this limit because you use this limit, and you already broke Lorentz invariance. And you know, if you have some, assume that you have just a B0 in some, I don't know, cosmic frame or something. You don't have a spatial B at all. You just have a B0. But then you'll have the motion of the solar system with respect to that, and our motion with respect to the sun and so on. And this will introduce something which is proportional with V over C, V of, you know, solar system with respect to galactic frame and so on. So you will induce, you will create a spatial B, which will be 10 to minus 3 or 10 to minus 4, 10 to minus 5 smaller than this. So you would still transmit it, somewhat weaker, but you'd still transmit it.
I still like to go back to Boris Kaiser's. How do you think this experiment? I don't understand. I mean, you know, it's very, very difficult to do, for example, the electric dipole moment on the electric. you have to take a single electron.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you read out? I mean, you have a box of, you say, material. How do you measure?
Oh. Okay, for. Okay, for this one, for the electrons, I'm not 100% sure how. Well. No, actually, in my notes, I have how you do it for the atoms. Well. And I have to find it.
That's
Yes, it is.
Choose your units.
Oh, well. But these people really take these experiments very seriously. And actually, Adalberger at CPT conferences talks about a new experiment which will improve this by 4 orders of magnitude. So, yeah, I'm not 100% sure how they actually do it. But, you know, if you think of it, they measure frequencies. This would look like a Zeeman splitting, an extra Zeeman splitting. It's B times spin. It's coupling of B to some field to spin. So, you know, that's how they measure Zeeman effects and very small corrections to that. They really measure frequencies, and that's always their argument. Frequencies are the best measured quantities in any experiment.
I wanted to ask, it looks like a small number if you're an experimenter, but it's even a small frequency.
In theory, what does one compare it to decide if that's an interesting limit or not?
Okay, so
for example, in the model you wrote down earlier, does that make it?
Well, for example,
if theta be new, do you get a prediction for this number?
Yes, actually that's exactly what we are using for. If you have non-commutative gauge fields, then you have exactly this kind of coupling of the B coming from the theta with a spin. So you have a sigma mu theta mu nu coupling, which is exactly B times spin. And you have these funny splittings, and you get sensitivity to scales of 10 to 14 GeV or so. People who started this Kostaleski's approach was that he always invoked string theory as the theory which would give the effective operators. So he would always have something like 1 over M Planck. So that's why he always argued that these experiments have to get to be sensitive to quantities of the order of 1 over M Planck. And they are getting there, actually. They are some. So.
What you've shown here is that if you introduce the kind of specific kind of CPT violation that you introduced, then because of electroweak gauge invariance, it leaks.
It leaks to electrons, yeah.
Electrons, you can put it that way.
Yeah.
And it leaks to an extent which is excluded.
Yeah, so basically what this tells you, it tells you that since this has to be smaller than 10 to minus 28 GeV.
But my question is, how generic is this example of CPT violation? To what extent can one draw the conclusion that any type of CPT violation which you try to confine to the neutrinos is going to leak into their doublet partners and therefore be subject to the constraint on the doublet partners?
Okay, so let me put it this way. First of all, here we really didn't want to put the CPT violating effect directly in the couplings of the low energy fields, because all the CPT violation for neutrinos was invoked as a way around of introducing light degrees of freedom.
Yeah, sure.
So you can always avoid these limits if you introduce light degrees of freedom. Because if you just never put in this N here, you just put artificially a 10 to minus 11 or whatever you need, you call a coupling for the neutrino, and you put the CPT violation in there for the neutrino, which is part of the left-handed doublet, low energy neutrinos, then you can get around these bounds. But what did you gain?
Yeah, I agree with that. Okay, so suppose we don't do that. Suppose we insist that whatever the details of the CPT violation, we're going to introduce it in what eventually become the heavy neutral atoms.
Yeah.
then is the constraint unavoidable, the experimental constraint?
I don't see a way around it. In this framework, there is no way around it. If you can put it in a different way here, maybe, but nobody knows how to put it in a different way.
Nina, but this constraint, what does it do to the term?
Okay, so what it? Okay, so let me. Which must to this one?
No, to the right. I mean that you're off.
Here? Yeah. So that's what I was about to say here. Now I have this constraint that this has to be smaller than 10^-28. Now, of course, this term comes for both neutrinos and antineutrinos. So these constraints, because I have this limit from electrons, I have the same limit for neutrinos. And now if I write this down in a more convenient way, remember what this term was. I have that B loop is the B at tree level. So I wanted to use, potentially, I wanted to use this B at tree level to solve the neutrino oscillations. But now I get this is times 1 over 32 pi squared. And then I have something which would look like b squared plus m squared over v log of this. And now my argument is, well, this thing is, since I already assume that this m is heavy, and I have a high UV cutoff, this thing is always going to be bigger than 1. So, yeah.
No, I'm sorry. when is the break? I'd like to ask another
OK. So assuming that, you know, if you really think of a normal CISO with m, which is really high, this would be really high. And now this, again, has to satisfy that limit of 10^-28 GV. But we take the very conservative approach where we say, well, let's say this is 1, even though we know that 1 would be a problem for this term, for the master. But even if this is 1, you still get the constraint that B3, you just lose a loop factor roughly. And this has to be lower than 10^-26 GV, which is roughly 10^-17 EV, which means it doesn't really work for oscillations. It's too small.
What I'm about to say almost certainly doesn't make any sense, but I'd like to try it out.
I don't know.
At a naive level, I'm very puzzled because what you told us is that somehow by seeing whether electrons do this, we've gained some constraint on CPT. So that's puzzling. And one way of asking the question, which is behind the puzzle, is, suppose we made this thing that you're calling B only to have a zeroth component.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no spatial consequences of it. Are we allowed to do that? And if we do it, does the Adelberger experiment still constrain us?
Well, that's what I was saying a little bit earlier. In principle, you can do it. And then you have to invoke this funny argument that this limit, so first, the first puzzle, right? The first puzzle was that looking at precession of electrons, you constrain CPT.
What's this got to do with CPT?
It has to do because the CPT came together with Lorentz violation. That's basically the answer to that. It's really, you know, these two come together. And because they come together, you use the Lorentz violation to constrain, you know, to constrain just this coefficient, which happens.
Yep.
Now here, we're interested at looking at the CPT part, but it's because CPT and Lorentz violation came together here. So that's why we get the constraint to start with. And it's true, we get it on the spatial components. Now, as I was mumbling before, assume that you only have this B to be non-zero, to be just B0.
Right.
But that you have to say in which frame. And if you say that it's just B0.
Adelberger's frame.
Yeah, so if you say that it's B0 in some cosmic frame, then because of motion of solar system with respect to that frame, you induce a B in the spatial components, which is a 10^-3 or so effect.
Yeah, yeah.
So you still have a limit which is less constraining.
By only this factor.
By 10^-3 or 10^-4 or something like that. So you still have it.
So, but if you are in the Adelberger's frame, then you don't have the limit.
No. Usually, no, no. On the assumption, no, standard assumption.
Just for part of the year.
right. No, the Colvin and Glasgow made a specific assumption which has been made by all the interpretations of the data. Namely, we assume that we are in the frame in which your the space components are zero, is the frame in which CMBR is isotropic. And then you do it.
Yeah.
And then you can use the rotation.
Yeah, so you always have to, since you validate Lorentz, you always have to define the frame where you're looking. Yeah, so. Okay, so that's about what I was planning to say.
I mean, how general is this argument that the generation of, that's
okay, so, I don't know. As I said, if you can avoid writing down this term and write down the CPT violation in a very different way.
Wait a minute now. This term remained only because you were using one flavor, right?
Yes.
If you use more than one flavor, then you have this.
You can have term, both. Right? You can have both. And then you would get really funny things. Because, for example, that term would give you flavor-changing things.
Flavor-changing neutral currents?
Yes. You can imagine anything. Of course, then you introduce so many degrees of freedom. You have to diagonalize the whole big thing with all the terms in there. But you can expect funny things happening there as well.
By the way, how do you diagonalize this simple? Just by orthogonal transformation?
Well, it's not really orthogonal anymore.
It's symmetric matrix as I see it, but...
It is.
Orthogonal, but in more dimensions. I mean, it's not just two; it is what, four plus one,
no,
dimensions.
This here actually is already just what I wrote here. Is well, it's of course misleading because this is just I wrote down just low energy part. But the right way to do it would be to go back to the full theory where you have all four of them. So you have two nu's. The new L and new L conjugate, and the NR and NR conjugate.
No, but okay, let's.
So it's a 4x4 thing that you have to diagonalize,
let's
really.
Let's stick with this. So now, what the orthogonal transformation diagonalizes this, what dimension does it have?
This is really a 2x2 matrix, but as I said, the correct thing to do was not that, but rather to diagonalize the initial 4x4.
Excuse me, but B slash is gamma mu times B mu, right?
Yeah.
It's a four-dimensional thing.
Sure, but that.
I mean, I'm missing something.
She's taking just one flavor.
Fine.
Yeah.
Yes, but I think she will not diagnose this one.
It's B and minus B if you want. It's this B here.
You can always get them in terms of B squared, B squared, and squared. How will you get that? You see the propagator, she has to multiply by the integer.
Yeah, so yeah, you can either look at it in that propagator kind of way. Or just write down, you know, you can write down the usual CISO terms, the matrix. Yeah, and you get here this extra minus B and B.
Just the big,
yeah.
Big slash. I mean.
Yeah, you get a B.
Right, gamma mu, you have a gamma mu. I never worked with CPT. I don't have any intuition about it. It's a very funny.
That's okay. We did work with it.
It's very hard. Yeah.
Have less intuition. Is that what you're about to say?
Yeah. So that's the problem. Once you put in CPT violation, you really don't understand many things, and that's why our approach is that the only way to still make sense and be able to compute anything is to add it just as an effective.
Yeah.
Term in a Lagrangian, because otherwise you have no idea what you're doing.
There was a nice paper by Wally Greenberg, too. Did you look at that one?
Which says that you want it or not, you end up with breaking of Lorentz invariants?
Or causality, violation of causality, when you put m not equal to m bar in a loop in a propagator. There's a cancellation between neutrino and antineutrino that doesn't happen.
Yes. Well, you have to, that's the problem. You always have to define what you mean by having different MN and bar, because it's kind of ill-defined if you just say it this way and nothing else. And where does it come from, and how does it go, and what else does it imply?
Since Gabriella is right across the hall from where I normally sit, one can't avoid knowing a little bit about
sure.
how she thinks about this. I think, in some sense, she tends to think about it the same way you do, but she views what you're calling B as, well, suppose that there is some external field, and the neutrinos are interacting with an external field, and it just looks like CPT violation to us.
Yeah, but she makes this extremely strong statement that the theory is still Lorentz invariant, and that's the part which I see it's no longer true.
Well,
and that's what hurt you.
By Lorentz invariant.
I mean that once you have this B.
I think you're just saying the same thing, actually, as she is, but you're saying it with the opposite spin put on it.
Who's B? Who's her B?
Pardon?
Who is her B? What is her B?
This you have to ask.
Okay, exactly, because that's the essential question.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, is that B just a constant something?
No, but for example, she has in mind things like the interaction, which is genuine, between neutrinos and matter as they pass through matter. That's, quote, a violation of Lorentz invariance, because there is a preferred frame. The frame
sure.
in which the matter is at rest.
Sure.
Now, you correctly say, okay, if she wishes to suggest that there is such a thing in cold vacuum, then she has to tell you what that thing is. And of course, she can.
And of course, in some way or another, you have to define this B. And this B will introduce some preferred something. This B has to come from somewhere. Or, anyways, I don't see how this B can be there and not break Lorentz, not define a preferred direction.
No, it defines a preferred direction in general, but
so then
the question is, how generic is the analysis vis-a-vis this limit, which is coming from experiment? My guess would be it is pretty generic, so there's a problem with the CPT violation picture.
So I guess
that's a key question.
I guess the alternative is put it directly, the coupling to this B, put it directly to the nu, not to the M. But then you introduce low energy, funny things that you cannot define. So that's the part that they always avoid. They avoid this M.
So I think Sergei asked the question and you answered it, but I want to understand. Suppose I put this in, now I have two neutrinos, an electron and a mu neutrino. And suppose I only put this into the mu neutrino. So I may avoid Adelberger's limit. Do I then get the same effect?
Then it gets somewhat more complicated, because you really have to go back to the, so now it was 4/4, now it doubles for both n and nu. You would have to add both this term, and then there was another term with a mu gamma mu, and to diagonalize that full thing. And what happens is that, this limit won't hold as it is for everybody, but you transmit a little bit from this, because of the mixings that you want for neutrinos,
exactly.
You transmit it to the other things as well. So this limit indeed applies for electrons and not for mu's and tau's, but you transmit it because,
You can deal with Adelberger, but then you wash the oscillation out.
Exactly. You erase all the mixing angles, that's it. And then, as I was saying, so this would be for the B. And now the A's are anti-symmetric and they couple different flavors. So I could imagine, I didn't really go through it carefully, but I could imagine that A could screw up things, like give flavor-changing weird processes and so on.
Large, you can't really avoid that.
Yeah, so it gets a lot more involved, and I don't know if it... I didn't go through all the diagonalizing 8x8 matrices or anything like that, but just...
Instead of coupling an axial vector to a background vector, can you do the same thing, coupling a pseudoscalar to a background scalar? Can you break CPT in the scalar sector?
That
sounds like a good thing.
How do you write down a CPT odd term for scalars?
If you had a term sidebar gamma phi psi couple group background scalar, is that CPT odd? I'm not sure.
Yeah, because it's a psi bar gamma of u psi, which is odd under CPT, so it's
that's it. Simpler to do. You just have some background cosmic scalar.
Well, yeah, but you have to. You still have to couple the term to something. Yeah, so the psi bar gamma mu psi, you have to do something with the mu, with the index. So you have to couple to something. Yeah, but and also, Kostolesky classified all the CPT violating terms that you can get with all the standard model fields and background fields. And I guess all of them are constrained to some level or another. You have to search for all.
The point here is in the frame of non-commutative geometry, the background field is this titanium, so you need some indices to construct.
Well, you don't have to invoke any non-commutative theory or anything. It's just, you know, you have a psi bar gamma mu psi, you have a gamma mu, you have to do something with a mu index.
So if you have a
you have to couple it to something.
Psi bar gamma phi psi, you need a derivative acting on psi. So it means that you will end up with a
Okay, why do I need a derivative? That's only if it's a suitable boson.
But you are going to couple to from background, and the background here is this E field, which is.
No, I guess that was Tom's question. How can you get rid of the B mu and have another background, which is a scalar, but you still have to, but you still have to do something with the gamma mu, so you still need.
Why do you need a gamma mu?
Well, so you started with a psi bar gamma mu psi, right?
No, psi bar gamma
phi psi. Probably. That would be okay, probably. Well.
That's Adelberg in the business. It seemed to be the theme.
No.
There are many other things.
I asked you why would we expect CPT violation to show up in the neutrino sector first, and you gave an answer to that. But Boris Kaiser jumped up and down and said, "Yes, you would absolutely expect that." Why did he say that?
Well, I guess I don't know. You have to ask him why did he say that. No, I know why I say that.
You can ask him.
I said it because I knew she would say what she then said.
Okay,
yeah, so my answer.
No brainer, it's come from the book.
My answer, well, but it doesn't have to be. That's the point. It doesn't have to be related to any bulk or anything else. It's just the fact that you do not want it to put these terms to start with at low energy. You don't like that. So you have to put it somewhere else and transmit it. Well, what is the most likely thing that you would have anyway at some higher scale and transmit something to low energy? Well, singlet neutrino is the first choice because, you know.
That's actually a different answer than the one.
Well,
but it's a good answer.
Yeah. So that's kind of independent of the bulk brain scenario.
Absolutely.
It's in any scenario.
Yeah.
It's just that you
and
already.
Does not have an analog for quarks.
Yeah. You already tend to invoke having another N field to get the mass for the neutrinos to start with. So that N, you want it no matter what. So then the easiest thing to say is, well, maybe that's the one, since it doesn't really come from our low energy theory, it comes from somewhere else. Maybe that's probably the most natural messenger of the CPT violation, wherever the CPT violation comes from, if it comes in the brain bulk scenario or in some other kind of funny theory.
What's the experimental number for mass differences in the KM system, the B system? Anybody remember that?
Yeah.
The ratio.
Mass scale is actually.
It's another four or five orders of magnitude smaller than the K short K long estimates. K short mass difference is about 10 to the minus 14 MK, and take another 5 orders of magnitude.
Yeah, so multiplied by MK. No, MK. So multiplied by G.
And that's related again to the same thing. That's only CPT violation. This is the Lorentz, which is a lot more constraining. So that's the idea. If you get around the Lorentz violation, you can relax somewhat.
Well, the electron positron must be from.
That's also very.
That's also very good.
Yeah, and also, yes, I don't know. This is kind of just. Yeah,
so
well,
we have to have neutrino beams pointing up this one.
Well, to be sensitive to whatever, 10 to minus 17 splittings, 17 eV splittings.
I have measured the mass.
The neutrino Michael Simon?
Yeah.
Well, you might discover this Lorentz violation without sinking.
Sure. Yeah, that's actually easier to put in CPT violation. CPT violation is really hard to get from anything.